Welcome to Main Street Banking, a podcast for community bankers brought to you by the Barrett School of Banking, located in the heart of banking, blues, and barbecue, Memphis, Tennessee. My name is Byron Earnhardt. I am the program director here at Barrett, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our corner of the banking world and hope that we can make your bank, your staff, and maybe even your day a better one. Okay, and welcome back to another episode of Main Street Banking. We're going to do another kind of deviation from the superhero community banking series, but really a dovetail off of the last one we did with Orlando McKay and last week and financial education. I'm really excited about today. We've got Darren Williams, the CEO of Southern Bancorp. On a personal note, I have worked alongside Southern Bancorp in some of the educational material that he's going to talk about today. I've seen the impact. I've seen the good it can do. And I've been working with for a CDFI bank. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But before we get too off deep in the weeds, Darren, thanks for coming on board and coming on the podcast. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself and about Southern Bancorp?
Sure, Byron. First of all, let me say thank you for having us on Main Street Banking. As you said, we have a long-standing relationship with Barrett School of Banking. We've sent several of our bankers to school, and thank you for your educational programs you guys provide. It's outstanding, and we really appreciate the service you provide to community banks. That's a big deal for us. Thank you. So Southern Bancorp. Southern Bancorp is a $1.6 billion community development financial institution, or CDFI. We're really three companies in one. Three companies make up the family of Southern Bancorp's businesses. So we have a holding company, Southern Bancorp, Inc., which I have the pleasure of serving as the CEO of. Southern Bancorp, Inc. owns the Southern Bancorp Bank, wholly owned subsidiary of Southern Bancorp, Inc. Again, it's $1.6 billion in assets. And we have Southern Bancorp Community Partners, which is also a CDFI, and it's a loan fund and financial development partner of SBCP, of the bank and the holding company. The holding company and bank are state members, Arkansas State Bank members of the Federal Reserve Board, so we're regulated by the state of Arkansas and the Federal Reserve, both for-profit entities. Southern Bancorp Community Partners, or SBCP as we call it, is a 501c3 tax-exempt CDFI loan fund. And they additionally also do lending, but they also provide very, very high-touch financial education and financial development services that help to support our customers. Collectively, we try to say we're three entities, we're one Southern. We work collectively, and as a CDFI, Community Development Financial Institution, for those who don't know, that is a designation by the Department of Treasury. And as a CDFI, 60% of your activity, basically they're counting your lending activity, must take place in distressed communities, kind of low and moderate income communities, basically is how you would characterize that. And so we're proud to serve those communities. We focus on providing a broad range of lending services as well as financial development services. We're proud to really be a part of the genesis of the CDFI fund. So we were started in the mid-1980s, then by Governor Bill Clinton, when he was governor of the state of Arkansas. He was looking for a way to stimulate economic opportunity in Arkansas's Delta, the Arkansas-Mississippi Delta, which had long suffered from the vicissitudes of slavery, particularly people of color, and low-wealth people were not getting access to capital. There was not a lot of economic activity going on. As you know, cotton was king and everything was great, but as the farm mechanized, the need for so much manual labor disappeared, and right, there was not really an injection of investment or support to lift that community up. And so he witnessed the first really development bank in the country, a bank called South Shore Bank, which was on the south side of Chicago, an economically depressed, predominantly African-American community that had suffered from redlining. That community had not seen investments, and several entrepreneurs got together, created a bank to intentionally invest in that underserved community. And what resulted was increased homeownership, increased business startups, more pride in the community, and really created economic opportunity in that area. And so he said, man, if that works in the economic depressed urban environment, can we create something similar that would work in the economic depressed rural environment? So he invited the folks from Chicago to Arkansas. And as governor, he was able to pull on the support of a number of folks, including the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation. Of course, Arkansas has its own Rockefeller. One of John D. Rockefeller's son, Winthrop Rockefeller, was our former governor. Yeah. And he left a number of jewels, including the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, which really focuses on serving and making Arkansas a better place. They invested in the Southern Bancorp at the time. And also Sam and Helen Walton had a passion for the Delta. So the Walton Family Foundation was one of our founding investors. In fact, Rob Walton, Sam's son, was one on our original board of directors. And so when Governor Clinton becomes President Clinton, he took his experience with Southern and with Shore Bank and said, I want to create, his idea was he wanted to create 100 development banks all across America working in these rural and urban distressed communities. But what resulted was the creation of the CDFI Fund at Treasury. And that fund provides funding support, grant support, and other technical assistance and various types of support to CDFIs. And proudly today, there are over 1,100 CDFIs in America. That's both banks, credit unions. The large majority are loan funds like SBCP. But we also have CDFI venture funds. And all of us work collectively in a network to serve underserved communities and underserved people to really try to create economic opportunity and lift those communities up. So that's not quick, but that's who we are.
No, that's great. And you know, you kind of got to some of my other questions.
No, I'm sorry.
That's awesome. And I can tell your passion for the CDFI program. You and I both share a passion like that because we've seen, as I said in the intro, we've seen it work in the lives and the communities and in the lives of the individuals that we serve in our banks. And I think that speaks very highly of you and speaks very highly of Southern Bancorp's mission and your leadership in the in that industry. It's I've worked alongside and seen y'all do it, and it's, I'm really excited about getting more information out there. Back up just a little bit on that. In our pre-talk, you had a quite an interesting journey to the CEO chair at Southern Bancorp. So would you mind sharing with our listeners your own story?
Sure, Byron. So I'm not a banker by trade. This is not what I grew up doing. I'm a lawyer by trade. And not just any lawyer. I was actually suing banks and publicly traded companies before I took this job. I attended Vanderbilt School of Law, and then I got my master's of law at Georgetown Law Center in securities and financial regulation. And I practice in the securities litigation arena, bringing class action lawsuits against publicly traded companies for violation of what we believe to be securities laws. And we represented large institutional investors. I represented state retirement systems, teacher retirement systems, state employer retirement systems, municipal systems, large institutional investors in the stock fraud cases. You know, people think Enron, think WorldCom, think those types of lawsuits.
Right.
And I really enjoyed that work. And we did a fair amount of consumer litigation as well, all in the class action context. And had occasion to actually sue a few banks, not many, but a few banks in that regard. So I was really, I enjoyed the practice and some days missed practicing law, missed my law partners. We had a national practice. We lived here in Arkansas, but we practiced all across the country. Okay. In fact, I've probably been in the Southern District of New York in courthouse more than any courthouse in Arkansas. Cause many of our cases were, you know, it was good work, stimulating work, got to practice with some great guys and got to go against some of the best law firms in the country and represent people who needed assistance. These were retirement systems, and any money lost was going to be money lost from someone's retirement. Or these were consumers who had suffered some harm. Oftentimes, the harm may be too small to bring an individual suit, but in the class action context, you could bring in those cases. And so we worked on a number of those types of cases. But in addition to practicing law, I'm a political junkie and have been since I was a kid, volunteering and working on campaigns forever. And I actually spent 3 terms in the Arkansas General Assembly. I was elected in 2008. And served from 2000 up until 2013, Got a chance to chair Judiciary Committee and actually was a speaker pro tem of the Arkansas General Assembly in my last session. And so that's actually where I got to know Southern. Southern, one of the unique things about Southern, our policy shop, we have a policy shop inside Southern Bank on Community Partners. So in addition to providing financial development products and services, we also work with state legislatures in Arkansas and Mississippi, as well as Congress, to mm-hmm. really promote legislation that will empower and lift up low wealth people. Our work really focuses around savings, around empowering people to save and removing barriers from savings. And in my time in the legislature, I partnered with Southern Bancorp or SBCP to bring legislation to really a focus on the refund anticipation loan industry, which is an interesting area. You know, during tax time, you see all those refund anticipation loan centers popping up. You see Uncle Sam and Lady Statue of Liberty, you know, waving flags to get you to come in and get your taxes done. Yeah, doing the twirl.
Yeah.
Get your taxes done. And what many people don't know, those refund anticipation loan, you're taking a loan against your tax return and paying a significant number of fees to get those loans. And in many instances, you can actually get that tax refund if you file electronically in, you know, 3 or 4 days. And so if you just wait a little bit, you can get the full refund as opposed to taking out a loan with high fees. And so that's the kind of work I did. So my, you know, I had a passion for serving underserved folks and those who had been defrauded, I guess, in my legal practice. And so that's what I was doing before I came here.
Well, it just goes to show you, you never know.
You never know. That's right.
You never know. It could be the guy that the lawyer suing you may end up being a good prospect to run your bank. No, I'm joking. I'm only half joking, but no, I just thought that was a really interesting story. The life path that that you went to arrive at where you are now. One I guess final thing on the CDFIs. What you know, sometimes we run into people. I mean, you and I, you know, bank down here. We've heard CDFIs. How would a bank go about becoming a CDFI?
Yeah. So you have to be certified by the Department of Treasury. They have a compliance division. Mm-hmm. You have to submit certification. And really the criteria is that, you know, 60% of your lending activity must take place in distressed communities. You have to designate what your target market is. And in that target market, you have to commit to really providing access to capital and credit and financial development services for underserved people and in that underserved location. And so, unfortunately for us in Arkansas and Mississippi, many, many communities and many, many census tracts qualify as distressed. And so the state of Mississippi, for example, and several in Arkansas, we have several CDFIs, loan funds, credit unions, as well as banks. And so there's a, you know, rich network of CDFIs in our two states that we work. But again, there are about 1,100 across America, serving native communities, serving minority communities, rural communities, even urban communities. We don't often think of urban communities like the New Yorks and the DCs and the Californias, Los Angeles, of having, you know, having lack of access to capital or to banking. But just because, I say this oftentimes, just because there is a bank on a corner or a bank near you does not necessarily mean that you have access to it. And so CDFI is really focused on serving what we call un- and underbanked people, people who are not fully using the banking system in a way that they can, which in many ways is costing them significantly amount of money in fees and other charges they could do if they actually had access to a bank account.
Right. So I would encourage if bankers and for the listeners to go and research and find out more if you have a passion for the underbanked and unbanked people of your community. Darren and I can both personally attest that it does amazing things in the live. We probably do 4 or 5 podcast episodes with you and I swapping stories, man. And I did. If you want to change, going back to our last podcast episode, if you want to change the conversation in your communities, you know, getting out there with financial literacy and using the CDFI program is a very good way to do it. Well, I just read in Bloomberg, I guess a few weeks back, that you were on the White House task force for an economic revival. And first, congratulations on that. And even more, thank you for representing the community banks there, Darren. I wanted to say that.
Thank you for
your service there and being at the table with the big banks on equal footing and standing your own. And from what I understand, not backing down. And I think our listeners will say, Darren, not back down from too much. Would you mind telling us about how all that came together? What did you discuss and what action came from that?
Yeah, so sure. So I'm not completely sure how we got invited to join. I have some hunches. You know, when the Paycheck Protection Program rolled out in an effort to keep Americans working during this pandemic, and I might say that I really appreciate the administration and Congress for the Paycheck Protection Program. That's a $650 billion program that did a lot of good in helping to keep the economy going. And we can talk about things that ought to be happening now. Right. But when the program rolled out early in the year at the beginning of this pandemic, it was a lifeline for small business and for their employees. Really, it's a program to really provide payroll support for business employees who, but for those paycheck protection dollars, may not have had rent money, may not have money to buy clothes, food, and shelter. And so we recognized that this program was going to be critical for our customers in our markets. You know, the Delta communities that we serve, already 26% of the population live below the poverty line. And you know, even pre-COVID, many of those communities and individuals in those communities struggled, and jobs were not plentiful. And so those few jobs were there, if folks lost that income, was going to be devastating. And so we recognized that we had to administer this Paycheck Protection Program. And so as the discussions started rolling out and as the SBA started to provide guidance and even samples of what the program was going to look like, we immediately started calling our borrowers. And I must say, you know, just how wonderful the 400 plus employees at Southern, how wonderful they are. I get to do these podcasts, but they do the work. And our team rolled up their sleeves and they went to work. And we, the very first day the program opened, there was a lot of confusion. You know, you're out a $650 billion program, there's a lot of confusion. And some of your larger banks wasn't sure if they're going to do the program. They weren't sure if there was, some of them said, you know, we're only going to do it for our own customers, not for other people. And what we said is we're going to do it for anyone who walks through the door, who meets the qualifications. We initially, of course, reached out to our customers and started calling them because we know them well. This is still community banking. It's all about relationships, and we knew them. And we actually, the very first day the program opened, we actually processed and funded our first loans while some of the larger banks, you know, didn't know what they were going to do. And we ended up doing about 1,300 paycheck protection loans for about $111 million, a little over $111 million. And I'm proud of the work that we did because in talking to the small business owners who we work with, they said, you know, but for those paycheck protection dollars, they're not sure what they would have done. In fact, I remember talking to one of our customers in rural Arkansas. He and his wife were meeting the night before we called them and told them the loan was approved and we're cutting the check, going to send the check to them and fund their loan. They were looking at their 18 employees and figuring out which ones are going to have to lay off. Mm-hmm. But when they got those paycheck protection dollars, they didn't have to lay off anybody. And so those families did not suffer an economic loss because they had access to those paycheck protection dollars. And so I was invited by Leland Vittard. Leland Vittard is a host of a show on Fox News. I had the pleasure of meeting Leland through Mac McLarty, who is one of the founders of Southern Bank Corporation. Mac and I have been friends for years. He's a big supporter of Southern. Was on our original board, and Mac introduced me to Leland when he was actually happened to be here in Little Rock. And so we just got a chance to start talking, and Leland has a show on Fox News on during the noon hour. And on one weekend, he says, "Hey, Darren, you guys doing those paycheck protection programs?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I want you to come on my show and talk about it." And I said, "Well, sure." So on a Saturday morning, I went on the show, and I think the White House saw that. I think that's how I got on the show because I was on a Fox News show talking about it. And what we were talking about is how critical those dollars were to the people that we were serving. We weren't bashing the administration. We're not bashing Congress. We're saying thank you.
Yeah.
Because our customers needed those resources. And I think that got their attention. And so they invited us to be a part of the kind of finance panel that you mentioned. And Byron, you might say I was out of place. So there was Brian Moynihan from Bank of America. There was David Solomon from Goldman. There were folks from JP Morgan. There were folks from Wells, from, you know, the biggest banks in the world. Those are the biggest banks in America. And there was Citi, Chase, and there was head of the independent community bankers, which was good out of Grand Rapids. And then there was me. There were 10 of us total, and there was me, the only CDFI. And you're right, I didn't back down. But I'll tell you what, a lot of thanks to the CDFI industry, but also to both David Moynihan of Bank of America and Brian Moynihan of Bank of America and David Solomon of Goldman, because we all got a chance to speak to the president, Secretary Mnuchin, SBA Administrator Cardozo, Larry Kudlow, and Ivanka Trump. And we're on this kind of two-way, we were kind of almost like a Zoom call. We all had our, you know, 3-4 minutes to give them our perspective. And Brian Moynihan went first, and then David Solomon went second. Both of them, to their credit, both of them raised the importance of CDFIs in reaching deep into communities that often get left behind. And so they were a great setup act for me. And so I spoke third. And so I was able to really express to the administration that it was important that you use intentional channels to reach deep into the community. If you only use traditional banks as the only way to distribute those resources, that a number of people who don't have ready access to banks, a number of rural communities that don't have banks, again, you know, 16 markets we serve, we're one of only two banks in town, and in six, we're the only bank in town. And so many small businesses that we serve prior to having a relationship with us did not have access to a bank. And so you really had to work, we said, with CDFIs and with minority depository institutions to ensure that all Americans, all businesses got access to those paycheck protection dollars. And we lobbied the administration and Congress that in the second round of PPP funding, that they make a carve out. Because what was happening is those bigger banks had, you know, much, much more powerful, robust technology platforms. They were sweeping a lot of that money. It was drying up fast. But in the second round, it kind of slowed down, but we were able to get a carve out of about $30 billion that went exclusively for CDFIs and for MDIs to ensure that the PPP dollars were, you know, broadly spread throughout the community. And so that was our chance to really talk to the administration about what we see, you know, in Main Street America. There's oftentimes a big disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street. And we were able to talk about what's happening kind of, you know, with Main Street banking. Right. And in Main Street communities. And so we're pleased to have that opportunity. And so we're able to have a channel to the White House. And even now we have a liaison, and when we have ideas, we have thoughts, we're able to send our thoughts, and they ask us to make policy recommendations. And so we did that as well. We've made several policy recommendations on how to really recover, to fully recover from this pandemic.
That's incredible. And I'm going to put the link to the Bloomberg article in the show notes, because I want our listeners to go in and read it. And it will make you proud to be a community banker. It will make you proud to be hearing Darren and getting to know Darren, because he's doing himself a disjustice. He did not back down, and he told the truth. He spoke truth to power. And regardless of wherever you are on the aisle, anybody that speaks truth to power in this type of environment, in this industry, you'd be very proud to know him. So even above the normal podcaster saying, check the show notes, please check the show notes and read that article, because it is 100% worth listening to.
Thank you, Byron. Thank you again.
You stepped up to the plate for us. There's a good bit of talk. You mentioned it earlier. There's a good bit of talk going on right now about PPP loans. And we talked a little about it. Let's put the bank CEO hat back on. What are some of the good and bad things that you've seen, and what are you expecting to see from the loan program?
Well, the good is the most good was what I talked about earlier.
Right.
Those dollars provided, you know, funding, provided money, provided payroll for a number of workers when it was critical, because they were, you know, the pandemic was really impacting the economy, and folks were going to not be able to buy groceries, pay rent, provide the basic needs to themselves. And so those dollars help keep the economy going, help keep people fed. So that was important. What's happened now is that partisan politics is what's happening now. And we're close to a presidential election. And so there's a lot of discussion. I think across the board on both sides of the aisle and in the administration, they all agree that additional paycheck protection dollars are needed. And right. They're all willing to do it. It's just caught up in bigger issues that they're not willing to give on right now. But I'll tell you one thing that did happen just yesterday. We processed all these 1,300 loans. The bankers across America process all these loans. Mm-hmm. And these paycheck protection loans are really grants. If you use the money correctly, and if you could document how you use them, then they would be forgivable. These are forgivable loans. They have, 24-month period to expend those funds, under the program guidelines, to do what you can only use for the things that they said, 60% of which was payroll. And so now it's time, people have exhausted those funds. It's time for them to seek loan forgiveness. And because the SBA had not until yesterday provided real guidance on how that loan forgiveness would work, there was a lot of confusion. And in fact, from the banker's perspective, putting the CEO's hat on, the way that we were going to have to process the loan forgiveness was going to be cumbersome and tedious and time consuming and really just unbearable to unworkable. Fortunately, Congress has now issued a greatly streamlined way to seek forgiveness for loans that were $50,000 and below. Mm. Now, I would have loved to see that number to be about $150,000 or right. more. In fact, Congressman French Hill, Congressman here in Arkansas, he and I wrote a op-ed that was featured in the Hill publication in Washington, D.C., yeah. And where we both call for a streamlined forgiveness process for any loans that was $150,000 or less. And probably 87% of our loans, were less than $150,000. So, right. that would 87% would clear a lot, but we even have like 900 plus loans, that are less than 50,000. So we, our average loan in round one was about $47,000, about $147,000 mm-hmm. in round two is about 47, I think. So our total together, we had less than about 85,000 average loan size. So my point is, a lot of our loans will qualify for that real ease of forgiveness, and right. that's going to help, particularly community bankers, because we did a lot of those small loans. That's going to help community bankers with a simple 2-page forgiveness, where the borrower basically has to certify that they use the money correctly. We submit that to SBA, and then of course the borrower has to keep their documentation for a period of years. But then it's forgiven. And so right. there was a lot of concern out there until that happened and there's still concern for those larger loans that are hoping that Congress and the administration wouldn't go back on their word. These things are forgivable because people want to, they want finality and clarity. So right. pleased that happened. That'll be a big deal for banks and for consumers who can have clarity on loan forgiveness.
Well, especially on things like that, those larger loans, that if there are problems with from a credit standpoint,
yeah,
if there are problems with those credits post COVID, post elect whatever, that frees us up to have the time to devote to right. handling those credits, and nothing against those small loans, those other ones, rather than being burdened down with the $10,000 right. PPP loan that right. look, save that business and save it. I'm not discounting that, but if I'm a shareholder and you're a CEO, I want you worried about the $250,000-$300,000 right. PPP loan with a bigger right. business that we need to talk yeah. about, and not doing 1,500 pages on the $10,000 loan. So, So I would encourage our listeners to be, get proactive in contacting their congressperson, reaching out to whomever will listen and ask, and not only vote, but actually get out there and say, look, we got to have a smoother way to do this. So,
absolutely.
So, yes, please take care of that. Well, I wanted to wrap it up as two Southern bankers here. You and I have got a lot of common, as I mentioned earlier. I've done some work with your bank here over in Mississippi Delta. From your perspective, sitting where you are, tell our listeners what you've seen here on the main streets. How is the economy doing in the deep rural South?
Yeah. So unfortunately, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It really depends on who you are and what industry you're in. In the Arkansas Mississippi Delta, we rely heavily on tourism. Right. Our hotels and restaurants, particularly during this time of the year, you come down to the Delta this time of the year, Byron, you're a blues player, there's a blues festival everywhere, every town, right?
Right. Not anymore.
And so, yeah, but not anymore because of COVID, that really shut down. And that's a significant hit, not just to those restaurants and hotels and businesses, but it's also a significant hit to the tax payroll, to tax revenue for those cities. We have been the longtime sponsor of the Hell in a Blues Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And
King Biscuit.
The King Biscuit Blues Festival, and that festival will, the city will double in size.
Right.
From visitors during that festival. And those are people who are going to eat at the restaurants, going to stay in the motels, and they're going to really help inject some tax revenue into that community. And that tax revenue is needed because that's a depressed community. It's an economic distressed community. And that helps fund state government all year long. Right. Well, you multiply that time, all the different, from the Sunflower Festival, the Juke Joint Festival, and all the festivals that go on throughout the Delta, those communities, not only those businesses, but also those city governments and those municipal governments don't have access to those tax revenue and those dollars anymore. And so I'm really concerned about the long-term impact of those communities. So right now, with so much stimulus that's been in the economy, many of our borrowers seem like they're doing okay. Our loan loss reserves are doing pretty well.
Right.
We have some challenges in that hospitality industry, but we're doing well in other places. But I'm worried about the long term impact. I'm worried about those folks who's the kind of the frontline workers who in the service industry, which makes up a lot of the employee base of some of our markets. Unfortunately, they can't work remotely. And so they're more susceptible to catching COVID, and then they're more susceptible to having job loss. And I think COVID is disproportionately affecting minority communities, particularly African-American communities. And the Delta has a significant population of African-Americans. And so really concerned about the health effects as well as the income effects of those service-oriented workers, particularly African-Americans in those communities, because of the stress on those communities. In fact, the Sergo Foundation, they have what they call the COVID Vulnerability Index. And what they've done, they've mapped the entire country, and they've looked at not just health concerns from COVID, they looked at the economic concerns, social concerns, educational concerns. They looked at all the different things, and they basically put together a vulnerability index by census tract and said, these communities are going to have more long-term impact from COVID. They may not have a large majority of the health impact right now. They're not New York City, right? They didn't have that big rush of COVID cases, but the long-term economic, social, educational impact of COVID is going to be deeper in some of these communities. And unfortunately, many of the communities, they ranked them from 1 to 10, 10 being the worst. Mm-hmm. Right there in the top 10 was Quitman County, Mississippi. Home of Sledge and Lambert, places like that. And so we know, looking at the past recession, Great Recession, we know looking at past history that underserved communities, low-wealth communities, often communities of color, it takes them longer to rebound. And so I'm optimistic that we will rebound because the Delta is resilient. I do know it's going to be tougher for us. And it's sad. And that's why we need injection of more stimulus dollars and paycheck protection dollars. And that's why I hope that they can put Congress and the administration can put the partisan politics aside and really help folks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And right underneath that, and getting bankers out there like you do, like Southern does, getting the bankers out there and working with working in the communities to teach basic financial principles and savings and things like that. And then if we can work to get that stimulus, I mean, it's
yep.
We want to change our, like I said before, if we want to change the conversation, we've got to get out and do work. So
that's right.
Well, Darren, I think you and I could probably talk another 45 minutes, hour and a half on all this. There's so many questions I'd like to ask you about all that, but I do thank you for your time and coming on the podcast and for what you've done with the White House Economic Task Force and for all that you've done over at Southern Bancorp. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Byron, thank you. We appreciate this program, but also appreciate the Barrett School of Banking. You're helping to educate community bankers, and we utilize your service. I encourage other community bankers to do as well. You guys do a great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's our episode for today. We hope you've enjoyed yourself and learned a little something. If you haven't already, please feel free to subscribe to our podcast and drop us a 5-star rating. You can follow us at Barrett Banking on Twitter or Barrett School of Banking on Facebook and LinkedIn. And we even have a new Community Banking Road Trip playlist on Spotify highlighting your favorite songs about your home state. Check that out and feel free to submit your favorite song about your state to add to the playlist. We have an ever-growing slate of classes, seminars, and webinars that are available, and not to mention our industry-recognized Graduate School of Banking every May, and we look forward to seeing you at any or all of our events. For more information, check out our website at barrett.ws. And from Memphis, the heart of banking, blues, and barbecue, we'll see y'all next time on Main Street Banking.